Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. The first hour today will be a replay of my interview with Brooke Seam from May 30th, 2023. Brooke Seam is a writer whose work on antidepressant withdrawal has appeared in the Washington Post, New York Post, Psychology Today, and more. Her debut memoir, May Cause Side Effects, is the first book on antidepressant withdrawal to hit the mass market, a notable milestone in the journey to bring global awareness to antidepressant withdrawal. She is also an award-winning chef and Food Network Chopped champion and founder of the newsletter Happiness is a Skill. This interview took place May 9th, 2023. Well, Brooke, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
I have been thoroughly impressed with, scared by, and heartened by the book you wrote, May Cause Side Effects, and I'm hoping you can tell us about which aspects of that book you want to promote most.
You know, I always struggle with this question because there really are five or six different kind of avenues and directions you can take from my book, and I want to talk about all of them all the time, and we never have enough time. But the main reason why I wrote May Cause Side Effects is because it is the first book that, you know, was bought by a traditional publisher and is being marketed towards the mass market, which is all very important on the subject of antidepressant withdrawal. And that is a topic that that affects tens of millions of people, but they don't know. And we need to make sure people understand this, because there are so many people on antidepressants all around the world, and people need to know that getting off of them is not as simple as getting on them. And so for me, the book is, it's a memoir, it's a pure memoir. It tells the story of what happened when I was pulled off Effexor XR and Wellbutrin XL in a rash and not very smart way in 2016. And it goes into the year I spent in severe antidepressant withdrawal. I hope that when people read the book, whether or not it's a patient going through withdrawal or a family member of someone in withdrawal or clinicians especially, they read the book and they are better able to identify what antidepressant withdrawal looks like, as opposed to what usually happens, which is people confuse it for either the reemergence of, you know, the depression or anxiety or whatever they were experiencing that led them to take these drugs in the first place. And in even worst case scenarios, people get labeled bipolar, schizophrenic, or a whole sorts of other mental illnesses because their symptoms actually look like the criteria for those illnesses. So the hope of this book is that it, you know, cuts down on misdiagnosis, that it actually helps people who want to get off these drugs get off of them safely so they can live the life that they want to, and keeps people from, you know, being on drugs they never need to be on for an illness they don't have. And that's kind of the work I do.
Yeah, and as you say, so often when people are going through whatever the backlash or withdrawal or, you know, the flood of symptoms that happen when they stop taking the medications, some of those people who are not as well educated about this topic think, oh, this is a recurrence of the symptoms that mm-hmm. say you need the medication. This means mm-hmm. you really are sick or crazy, or mm-hmm. And that's rarely the case. The other point I wanted to make is that the book is such a powerful read because mm-hmm. you're such a good writer.
Well,
and that has it's a blessing and a curse because people might take it more as a novel or that you're just sensationalizing this, whereas because I have experience in the field, I know this is just a raw gut level explanation yeah. of the horrors of mm-hmm. going through withdrawal in a very rough and, as you said, in not a very intelligent way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I am an artist and a writer at heart, so I worked for many years really massaging the language to make sure that it was getting the feel of the experience across in a powerful way, but also a compelling way, because, you know, at the end of the day, storytelling is what changes, you know, that's the movement, that's the story. People can get data and research thrown at them all day, but we're all kind of numbed out on that, or we think it doesn't apply to us. It really doesn't matter unless you're getting to the emotion of it. So that part was so important to me. And, you know, it's an extremely accurate representation of what was happening. So, you know, if it makes people uncomfortable, then I think they need to look at that within themselves, because this is what happened to me.
And, you know, the wonderful writing had me, you know, staying with it and wanting to, you know where it goes. And so you're in that page turning kind of a process, and it can be easy to forget that the topic is so intense and so mm-hmm. crucial for us. Whereas you say, many, many people are struggling with this, either staying yeah. on meds for years at a time and or getting off of them before, you know, there's an appropriate evaluation and a way to, and you mentioned at the end of the book, the idea of hyperbolic tapering, mm-hmm. Which is something that, you know, people like Peter Bregan, when he writes about, you know, psychiatric mm-hmm. drug withdrawal in his book, he talks about how there really isn't any prescription about how to come off of these unless you're deeply connected to the individual and their experience yeah. and their symptoms.
Yeah.
And that's rare to find in a professional, in a medical doctor. I mm-hmm. think you mentioned in the book that there aren't that many people who are well-versed. You went to a psychiatrist who's supposed to be a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as though they take offense at the idea that you want to go off
mm-hmm.
the meds. And,
mm-hmm.
and rather than being really well-versed in how to do that and getting to know you as a person and then working with you at a plan for you, you had a horrible experience because you had pretty much the opposite, somebody who was just mm-hmm. going by a formula and
yep.
basically you know, setting up the appointments and making sure you could pay for them. And then, you know, it was kind of heartbreaking to read when you went to say, I really want to go off of the second medication. And basically you heard from the psychiatrist, a female nonetheless, good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck with that. So.
Yep.
So.
Never saw her again.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about what you've learned looking back on this about how an intelligent, creative person like you have been thrown into the situation or grown into the situation where the adults in your life thought you need, you know, a whole bunch of medicines in you for the next 15 years. What was,
yeah.
What do you understand about that looking back on it?
The context here is really important because it adds another layer of complexity to my situation. And so for me, what happened is my father died suddenly when I was 15, and this was 2001. So we have to really think about the time and place there. Although I would not like this has gotten any better. So maybe the time and place doesn't matter. Bottom line is that my father died, and, you know, I had a reaction to that, obviously, because who wouldn't? And, you know, I wasn't actively suicidal. My grades hadn't absolutely plummeted. I wasn't hanging out with the wrong crowd or, you know, suddenly got into street drugs. I was just stoic and in shock and lost. I mean, these are things that I think are completely normal reactions. And so I was taken to a child psychologist who called up my mother one day and said, "You're wasting your money because what Brooke needs is a psychiatrist, not a psychologist. So I'm diagnosing an anxiety and depressive disorder and recommending medication." Here's the name of a child psychiatrist I recommend.
And you were 15 at the time.
I was 15, yeah. So, and not only that, you know, we had a small family. It was my mom and me and my dad. And so losing my dad meant that my mom suddenly didn't have the other person who she would bounce ideas off of when it came to me. Furthermore, she was grieving herself. So, and she's not a doctor. So, you know, what else is she going to do other than say, well, okay, we'll follow the expert's recommendations. And so I was taken to a child psychiatrist, and within 10 minutes, as you do, I had a couple scripts, and so I just started taking them. And, you know, I wasn't in the position to question the adults or the experts around me. I mean, we've all grown up to listen to doctors and, you know, go to the doctor and trust that whatever they say is truth. And so when the doctor told me, the psychiatrist told me that I had a chemical imbalance in my brain, and, you know, I was depressed and anxious, and I was going to need to take these antidepressants, who was I to question that? Like, why wouldn't I believe that? And, you know, on top of that, it validated what I was feeling, because I was depressed, for God's sake, because my dad had died 6 months before. I mean, this isn't a shocking revelation, but nobody likes feeling bad. Nobody likes feeling sad. And, you know, for me, my entire trajectory had just fundamentally changed. So not only was I, you know, grieving and sad and depressed and all these things about the actual physical loss of my father, but it completely reframed my, you know, that was the moment when I realized that I wasn't going to live forever. And we all have that moment. It comes. It usually doesn't come when you're 15, but these are existential anxieties that are valid, that need to be worked through. So,
well, there's also
had a reason.
There's also the idea that it wasn't highlighted, but a little bit later in the book, I think you revealed that your parents had a family business.
Yeah.
When your dad died.
Mm-hmm.
So then it wasn't just you lost your partner. She also then had to do all this extra work with the business. Mm-hmm. And you also reveal through the book how your father really struggled with his anger. He had a real clear way to express his anger.
Yes, he did.
but not maybe so much fluency with the subtleties of other emotions. And you were very close to him, so
yeah,
you did the best you could, but you bottled a lot up. And then I seem to remember a situation with going to the doctor to need one stitch in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And having all of these tears come out, and then your mom having mm-hmm. to try to explain to the doctor, wait, her dad just died. And
yeah,
it's that kind of just the flow of life, that if you don't have anything other than a bottle of or a list of prescriptions in your toolkit, you just give prescriptions. But there are so many other things that could be done with a 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Who had a limited range of exposure to various emotions and lost her father, that you didn't get the benefit of. And then because you were so intelligent and because you were so driven, you just kept churning through life with, describe for us what you were churning through it with. What was the impact of having all of those medicines in your system?
I mean, they certainly didn't really make me feel any less depressed, or I would say, you know, like most people commentate, the lows are higher and the highs are lower, right? Like it took all the edges off. It numbed me out. So you have the impression of being better when in reality, you're just numbing yourself through whatever's going on. I mean, I still, you know, had the ability to focus on my SATs and graduating and going to college and all those things. But what it took away was curiosity and wonder and ambition. It just kind of made me this, you know, slave to the expected, right? Like I needed to go to college and then get a job and then get an apartment and make money. And there was, but I never had, because I was so kind of disconnected from myself, I never had the ability to turn inward and say, what do I actually want and what kind of life do I want to live? And I, you know, I do think that on some level that's common for people of that age, but there should be a level of curiosity and experimentation happening at that time where you kind of figure out what you like and what you don't like. I never did that because I was always defaulting to the path of least resistance. Because from my perspective, you know, I had been given this message at a very formidable age that I had a chemical imbalance in my brain, so I was kind of fundamentally always going to trend toward melancholy and be broken. So if that's the message you receive and that's the identity that you create, then there's no reason to be curious about the world, because it doesn't matter if you're, you know, an artist or, you know, a banker or an insurance agent, you're going to be depressed no matter what. So just do what's the easiest, what's the path of least resistance, which at the beginning doesn't really seem to be that consequential, but you start doing that for 5, 10, 15 years, like I was doing, you eventually get to a point where you're living a life that's so wrong for you that the depression just continues being your friend along the path, and you have a rationalization for it, so you have no reason to question it.
The other thing,
when in reality, maybe your life is wrong with you.
And the other thing that you write about so well is that your actual perceptions were changed dramatically. You were numbed down. You didn't see
colors.
Yeah,
my sensory perception.
And you tolerated burns, you know, from the bakery, mm-hmm. and you didn't really see colors as well as you started to, mm-hmm. as you came off the medication. I think you wrote about it beautifully, and it's the kind of thing that you couldn't even understand until after you come off the medication.
No.
Because it was your norm. It was for 15 years, it was your norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like if someone, you know, dripped just a little bit of like liquid cellophane on you every day for 15 years, eventually you're going to be covered in this layer of plastic. And you're not going to realize how you've been losing little bits of perception. I mean, literally, like when I started to get off the antidepressants, literally colors brightened. It's not a perception. This was literal that colors got brighter and my hearing became more sensitive and clothing and, you know, what I like to watch on TV, what I like to eat, it all changed. I mean, it was literally affecting every single aspect of my personality and my perception of the world, and I had no idea because it was so normal to me.
And as you say, when you started so early, it's such a formative period, 15, 16, mm-hmm. 17. What do you see now, looking back on it, that you think allowed you to break free of it?
Of the antidepressants, of the depression?
Of the antidepressants, of the routine.
Well, I had a bit of an extenuating circumstance because I had had this opportunity to travel around the world for a year that dropped into my lap out of nowhere. And I kind of couldn't ignore that. It was such a big opportunity. And I realized that logistically I was going to have a lot of problems with the number of drugs I was on and actually getting them all around the world, and I couldn't source them from the places I was going because we weren't going to big cities. We were going to little towns and villages and islands, and so I couldn't, you know, reliably get my effector in Europe where venlafaxine is banned. Like, it's not even legal there. So I said, I've got a problem. and so that was kind of the first reason why I said, okay, let me see if I can get off these and discover my baseline and, like, maybe I need to be on something else. Maybe I wouldn't. I really didn't know, but I knew I had to at least address the situation in hand. And so then when I started to actually get off of the drugs, you know, that, and I was having such severe withdrawal, but I was also having these little moments of, you know, when the colors changed and brightened, it was this kind of holy crap moment where I said, if these drugs were affecting the way I literally see color, what else did they affected? And so there was this, I was really angry because I felt like I had been robbed of beauty for 15 years because, like, color is wonderful, you know, and to have not really seen that for 15 years, I just deeply pissed off. Combine that with some world-class stubbornness, I just said, you know what, I'm not going to do this. Like, I'm going to ride out this withdrawal. I didn't know how long it was going to last at that point. But I just was so angry at the situation that I said, we're getting through this and I'm going to get off these drugs. And it was that anger and stubbornness that actually pushed me through the worst of it, because I knew that I couldn't go back. I couldn't, like, go from seeing color and then go back to everything being muted. I just couldn't do it. It made me too obsessed. I wanted to know who I was. My only frame of reference was when I was a child. And my dad was alive. Like, that was just, I'm so angry. I still am angry about that.
Well, and the other thing that you write about so powerfully is that even though you were on them before you started trying to get off of them, you were still very, very focused on ending your life.
Mm-hmm.
And had a plan. And, you know, so whatever benefit was supposed to be given to you from taking these meds, it wasn't ending the suicidal depression.
Right. And if they're not doing that, then what the hell are they doing, right? I mean, it's not exactly a glowing advertisement for their efficacy.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is so often the case when people like Robert Whittaker write about it, you know, the anatomy of an epidemic. By a number of different measures, if these drugs are supposed to be helping and we have so many of them and they're being given to so many people, then why are the rates of people going on disability for mental health skyrocketing? You know, why are so many people more having to have them in this country and not other countries, et cetera? So there's really powerful questions to be asked. And a book like yours, I think, can really help people on that individual level and on the systemic level step into questioning this. So thank you for being willing to put it out there so honestly.
You're welcome. And it's interesting because the suicidal ideation really pretty much evaporated when I got the drugs out of my system. I mean, even in withdrawal, when it was just so hard to handle, the suicidal impulses disappeared. And, you know, it, I know I'm not the only person who has felt that shift. So it really brings into question, at least for a percentage of people, for me, like, at what point do we maybe face the uncomfortable truth that at the end of the day, at least for some people, and we've done far more severe things in this world for far fewer people than this has affected, you know, when do we start to acknowledge that maybe the drugs are actually part of causing the problem, or at least prolonging it? That's an individual question, I think, but for me, it's very clearly the truth.
Well, unfortunately, you know, more and more people are coming through medical school and then finding books like Robert Whittaker's and others and perhaps yours and Peter Bregan's and saying, wait a minute, none of this was covered in medical school. And what if there's a whole different range of ways to help people with mental health struggles than just matching a list of symptoms with a list of medications?
Yeah, and I would actually really like to see a bifurcation of psychiatry. I think that we really need to treat never medicated people differently than we treat medicated people, because the assumption of the DSM is under the assumption that you are not influenced by a psychiatric drug. So if you have a spontaneous schizophrenic episode, then in theory you're supposed to follow the directions in the DSM or whatever and, you know, go down that route. That's a very different scenario than someone who's been on powerful psychiatric drugs, possibly multiple psychiatric drugs, for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, and then has some sort of break because the medication was changed, and now they're giving a diagnosis of schizophrenia and treat it as if it was, you know, a first-time thing. Like, it makes no sense to me. And I see so many issues as a direct result of polypharmacy, of people getting moved all over on their drugs, of, you know, being prescribed one drug on Monday and 2 Mondays later, they're saying, oh, it's not working, let's give you something else. Like, these things create these psychological symptoms. So I would love to see, and I think that a lot of people want to put you in a box of, you know, pro or anti anything, right? I think that realistically, these drugs aren't going away. So we need a lot more education and true expertise and specialists on how they actually work, what the different side effects are and manifestations in people. So if someone comes in and they say, hey, I was 17 years old and I was diagnosed as bipolar with depression and ADHD, I'm on one drug for each of these, and now I'm having these symptoms, I want a doctor to look at them and say, hey, you are on a ton of competing drugs. We need to figure out your genetic ability to metabolize these. We need to maybe get you off a couple of them and see if symptoms improve before they are immediately just, you know, hospitalized and tranquilized even more. And that is a different practice than someone who is in a crisis for the first time, or they're having their first bout of, you know, depression and anxiety, and maybe they're in a situation that's so extreme that everyone involved thinks they need a little bit of, you know, psychopharmacological help. That is two different practices entirely, and yet there's no distinction, there's no nuance at all, and like, not, it's not even to say about, you know, the 40-year-old woman whose both kids leave for the first time and she's feeling a little bit of empty nest syndrome, and so her OBGYN or her JP gives her some Paxil. That's a totally different problem too. But that's the point. The point is that this is extremely diverse. It's extremely nuanced. It's extremely representative of the individual who's involved and what happened to that individual. And yet we put these stupid blanket diagnoses and prescriptions on everyone and then walk around wondering, oh, we don't have any better solutions. And it's almost, you know, why doesn't it work? It's just, it's not that hard. But no one wants to look at it because that takes time and effort and forces us to face some very uncomfortable truths.
Well, and it requires changing a paradigm in the way the medical field practices that. And, you know, there's all kinds of dynamics and political reasons why that's challenging, but the most important relative to what we're talking about is the clinical impact on people. And so I just like the fact that a book like yours puts it out there for people that there is the option, that, you know, there are more and more people. There is not a flood, it's not a tsunami yet of people who are studying this and willing to help you get off with a hyperbolic tapering or whatever, but it is an option. And you're just one of the many people who are experiencing that, but you're putting it out there in your story, so it makes it more available to people.
Yeah, I generally don't really go through life with a cynical outlook, but I do have a fairly cynical view of the paradigm shift here. I don't think it's going to come from the top down. And I think if you wait for science to come around and solve this problem for you, you're going to be waiting a lot longer than you want. So therefore, it becomes an individual problem to be solved, both on the part of the individual and on the practitioner. It takes both. And so this is what's entirely frustrating to me, is that I get the paradigm and the system we're in, and it's profit-driven, it's politically driven, it's, okay, fine, we know that. But this is also not something that you don't have the power to change, address, and research on your own, whether or not you're a doctor or a patient. So the fact that we have psychiatrists and doctors who, it's your job to be the expert and to go down the road of continuing education and to read a wide variety of research on this topic, and they don't, that frustrates me, because that influences the patient. And in the same vein, if you're a patient, it's kind of on you now to actually have some medical literacy and understand how research happens in this country and how what we know about these drugs that you might not see on the commercial. Like, you have to take your agency into your own hands a little bit, because you can't expect your doctor to do this. And even the most well-meaning doctors in the world, of which I think a lot of them actually are, they just have bad information, they don't have time because they're so bogged down with an absolutely crappy insurance system. So a big reason why they can't do their own research and stay up to date is because they're too busy trying to find codes in order to get paid to do their job. Like, it's, the system's totally broken, but you can fix it for yourself within if you take a little bit of initiative, and that needs to happen on both ends.
Well, and that's the kind of thing we've been trying to promote with this podcast of psychiatrists like Dr. Jody Skillicorn, who got out of her medical degree and then read Anatomy of an Epidemic and said, oh, my gosh, I've got to reeducate myself and figure out how to help people in a different way. And then she wrote the book Treating Depression Without Medication. And I think she's one of six or eight different integrative and or functional medicine psychiatrists that we've interviewed just on this podcast alone in the past two and a half years. So it's happening that people are waking up to it. But as you say, it's going to happen from the bottom up. It's not going to happen that the system is going to change at the insurance company level or at the medical school level.
Yeah, unfortunately, I want to speak to as many medical schools and as many residents possible. I think that you got to plant this seed early. The most frustrating conversations I have are with people who've been doing this for a while and just kind of refuse. But when you get in the medical school, you just get them earlier. And I don't expect people to change careers. All I'm asking is that, hey, you need to know that psychiatric drug withdrawal, and specifically antidepressant withdrawal, is a very real thing. This is what it looks like. This is how you can avoid it. Here are the PET scans that show, you know, the plasma levels and the CERT occupancy of each individual drug that will explain to you why you can't just say, hey, cut this pill in half for 2 weeks and then stop. Like, we have the research. It's not like I'm some, you know, just conspiracy theorist here. I can show you the actual PET scans that were done for this drug and explain this. Why me, the chef, is the one having to do that is a baffling question. But here we are. And
here,
so I'm going to do it.
And thank you for doing it. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is, what do you think you learned most about or learned most from your year of travel? As, you know, through the fog of all of the extra intensity of the withdrawal in the first, you know, few months of it. That was a fascinating part of your book. And you had such detail for the first couple stops. I thought, she's either going to, because we're running out of pages in the book, right? She's either going to say, oh, I dropped out and it didn't work out, or she's going to magically wrap this up. So what would you say you learned most from that year of travel?
So, I mean, the real key part about the travel in my book is I often wish that when people reach out to me and, you know, they're in their own withdrawal process, I wish that I could replicate the situation I was in for them. Because what it did for me is that the organization and the program I was doing, we traveled to a different place every month. So 1 month I was in Malaysia, and the next month I was in Thailand, and then Cambodia and Croatia, and so on and so forth. And what that did is it completely removes any external stimuli that you can blame for your own problems. So your environment's constantly changing. So you can't, you know, in my case, I had spent so many years creating a narrative in my head that the source of my emotional distress was because of my business partner or living in New York or not having enough money or not, you know, finding the dream partner, right? All of these things. There were so many reasons that I could look outside of me and point to and say, that's the problem, if I could just fix that. Because I was in the same place doing the same thing. As soon as I started traveling and had absolutely, you know, gotten rid of every single one of those external stimuli, and furthermore, that wasn't following me from place to place, because if I was upset about something in Malaysia, well, that was going to go away in 3 weeks when I was in Thailand. And, oh, shocker, there was something new. And so what you learn really quickly in that constantly changing environment is that the problem is you. And people don't like that, because especially for, you know, emotional and mental health, it feels so outside of your control. It feels like something that's happening to you. But I looked at it and said, okay, if I'm taking myself with me wherever I go, I know that I have the power to figure out how to do this differently. And I was forced to, because the withdrawal symptoms were so bad that I was desperate enough to start trying new things. And as I started doing that, what we were really doing was kind of addressing all of this, you know, kind of deep existential wounding. Then things started to get better, and I'm not as triggered anymore because I healed the issue, and so on and so forth. So it got to a point when I was writing where I was finally starting to feel well enough that it wasn't a book about traveling. It wasn't a travel memoir, so there was no need to keep writing. So that's why you didn't get
I think you did a beautiful job of explaining how it made sense then to just give quick summaries of the other stops, because you had done such an integration of dealing with your new level of perception and getting through the withdrawal. And as you talked about facing some fears, you know, learning to scuba dive and doing it with all people that weren't your family that you grew up with. They weren't your best friends for years. As you said, the environment and the people kept changing, and yet you were able to make that progress. So I could kind of sense as you were writing that you were building that core strength that's so essential for all of
us. Exactly. Yeah.
That was really shaken to your core when you were 15 and you lost your dad. And then the meds got thrown on it. And
I mean, I wasn't really given the opportunity to build tools or resilience when my father died because I was medicated so quickly. So withdrawal was a crash course in that. And then even more so, I had to then kind of learn all the things that I think I would have learned more slowly in my 20s, but that I didn't learn because I was, you know, living in a state of despair the whole time. And once I, you know, got off the drugs and suddenly actually wanted a future, I wanted to live, then I had reason to gain some tools and to really get to know myself and understand the flow of emotion and intensity and the fleetingness of everything and how we're meant to change and grow and change our minds and, you know, pay attention to how we feel around certain people or certain places or experiences. It's all of those things that if you listen to it, it's what really leads you to the life that you want. But if you ignore that, then you end up in a place you don't want. And
And the other thing is that during that period in your teens is when most of us from a relatively healthy family start to learn how to integrate the good stuff we're getting from mom and the good stuff we're getting from dad and the not so good stuff from mom and the not so good stuff from dad. And you didn't have a chance to do that because of the grief that wasn't processed and then the, kind of this concrete shell around you that was formed by the dumbing of your senses, et cetera, from the medications.
Yeah.
How long has it been now since you've been off the meds?
Long enough that I'm sort of losing track. So I think we're approaching the 7-year anniversary. I believe I got off the last drug sometime in the summer, like August of 2016. So, and I was on a bunch of other prescription drugs too for physical stuff that had appeared within the year of being on antidepressants. So that's the other factor of this too,
thyroid,
right?
That the antidepressants. Like
The antidepressants caused physical side effects that we then had to medicate with more pharmaceuticals. And so I didn't know up or down with my body. I mean, it wasn't just an emotional problem. It was my thyroid was a mess. I had something called bile reflux disease. I got off all of those drugs because I was just at a point where I said, I need to be really clear of everything and just see where I'm at. And I haven't taken a prescription drug now in 6 years. So no, the thyroid problem went away, which is miraculous. The bile reflux disease went away. Everything disappeared. Took a while for me to stabilize, like for my physical body to stabilize as well, but I just gave it time.
Are you noticing still little things that are still changing with the further you go away from the medications? I'm thinking
from a physical standpoint?
From the mental, emotional, physical, the whole thing. I'm thinking about Jill Bolte Taylor, who helped rewrite the ideas about what happens after stroke. When, you know, she was a neuroscientist herself who had her own stroke. And it used to be that they would tell you that most of what you recover after a stroke you get from, you know, after 6 months. And if you haven't gotten it at the end of a year, it's not coming back. And she was rewriting that because she was documenting how things were coming back in her functioning 7 and 8 years after her stroke.
Yeah, these are just such crappy messages to give to people. I mean, I understand that, you know, like, regardless of whether or not the research is sound, I understand, like, I love science. I love that we have science and research in order for us to give a general, you know, umbrella of what might be happening. But it's the law of averages, and you can't apply averages to the individual. So to tell them, oh, you're not getting any feeling back after a year, God, that's just, it's cruel. It sets people up for failure. And so, yeah, for me, I mean, there are definitely still some things that I will never know and often wonder if this would be different had I never been on the antidepressants. The like sexual health side effects, I really wonder about. You know, there's PSSD, which is post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, that I know I experienced a level while I was medicated. And things have gotten better in the years since I haven't been medicated, but I still feel the only description is rather stunted in a way that I think had to do with the timing, because I was medicated right at puberty. And I think that that has actually fundamentally altered that aspect of my life, which, you know, it's something I wasn't comfortable enough to talk about when I was writing the books. It's not in there. It's something I've become more comfortable with the older I've gotten in, and I have seen improvement on that, but it's taken a lot of work and emotional work and, you know, counseling work and forgiveness and grace. And so that's, you know, that's one aspect. I'm still dealing with gut health issues that I think were caused by the long-term use of all these psychiatric drugs. No, all the drugs I was on, actually. You've got biome stuff. I mean, 90% of your serotonin is created in your gut, right? So if you're on an antidepressant, it's likely that that's affecting your gut somehow. So I'm looking at a stack of supplements over here that I'm working on to help just still get my digestion functioning in a non-problematic way. And then emotionally, you know, what's interesting is that nothing I've experienced since withdrawal has been as bad as withdrawal, but sometimes you can get little snippets of sort of what I felt in withdrawal. Like if I'm feeling pretty emotionally dysregulated or my nervous system is dysregulated, I'm still very sensitive to noise. That was something that was a big problem in withdrawal for me. And I still feel that if I'm not kind of feeling emotionally strong or if I haven't been taking care of myself. But now I just look at that and I say, okay, well, if you're having trouble being outside today because it's too loud, that probably means we need to adjust what's going on in our life, right? Like meditation needs to come back, probably need to call your counselor. Let's really look at what's going on because something is breaking me down. So what this whole process did is it just allows my compass to be, it's much more attuned. I can tell when I'm going off in the wrong direction far earlier than a crisis. And so then I can bring myself back. And it's beautiful. And that's what you learn. And I mean, God, if everybody had the tools I have and the ability to be as in tune with your inner state as I am, I don't think we would be where we're at from an emotional health level in this country, even in the world. Like, but you have to learn it and you have to have people who support you. And I got really lucky in the sense that I, you know, my mom never believed I was mentally ill. So she was basically fighting against this the whole time. And so when I finally decided to listen to her, then I realized she was right the whole time. If you don't have that, if you have...
What was the first name of the counselor that she...
Alan.
Alan. Yeah. And that was another part of the book where I thought, well, you know, you clearly got lucky with him as a coach and helping you tune into what's actually going on in your system and not rationalizing all kinds of things about it, but being with it and letting it speak to you. That was just a beautiful piece of work. It's so in line with all the best stuff I've ever learned in 49 years doing therapy that,
I mean, when we try and use our brain to fix this stuff, I think we're going to reach a dead end every time because so much of our mental and emotional health lives in our body. And our brains are just the little monkeys trying to make sense of it all. So we kind of got to get out of that.
Am I remembering this correctly? Did you say that your mother went and trained with Alan?
She did, actually. So she, my parents had owned a family business together. And then after I went through withdrawal and had just had such a huge transformation, she said, I'm not doing this anymore. I want to help people. And so she sold her business. And now she is in a second career where she works with people. A huge percentage of her clientele is either in withdrawal or recovering from long-term use of antidepressants, and so she works with them through multiple modalities now. So she uses the one similar to Alan, which is Compassion Key. She's also she uses a lot of hypnotherapy, and like, she's so good. And to watch her, to have her tell me, you know, she'll tell me, oh, I have this client who, you know, obviously it's all, I don't get details, but she'll say, oh, I have a client who had this happen to them. They've been medicated since they were 9, and today they took their last, you know, Paxil, and they're doing well, and it's been 20 years. I mean, you don't hear these kind of success stories from standard psychiatric practices, and it's just, it's the coolest thing, and I wish we could clone her a million times to help more people.
I know the feeling. Occasionally I run into somebody that's just so good at that. Whatever they're doing, I wish we could have every therapist be that good, or every coach be that good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I realize we're pushing up on one of my hard stops here because I have another patient coming in, but I wonder if you could just take a breath and get centered and let me ask you to think, is there something we've already talked about that you want to highlight, or something about your recovery or this book that you want to mention that we haven't even touched on yet?
I've been thinking a lot about kind of what the legacy of this work is and what I want people to walk away from. And I think I really want, obviously, more information and education about psychiatric drug withdrawal. But I think I would also like people to, my goal is to have people just start to question the stories they've told themselves around mental illness or psychiatric drugs as a concept. Because we've really been sold a narrative, and we've been sold a narrative through advertising about what these things are. And so many of the stories I hear from people, they can always be traced back to a thing. Either it's something that happened to someone when they were a kid, or it's a series of bad things that happened to them, or in some cases it's just years of being switched from one drug to another, and nobody puts two and two together that, hey, every time you switch a drug, you have a manic episode. Maybe it's the drugs. Like, I just think that we've really narrowed our view of this in a way that's hugely detrimental when it really needs to be expanded. The other thing that I think is really important and that really needs to be demanded from patients, because it's not going to come from the top down again, is the idea of truly fully informed consent. You know, I was on a call with a psychiatrist 2 days ago, and through a course of our conversation, he said out loud, he's very pro-medication to start. He's extremely pro-medication. And he goes, at one point he says, you know, antidepressants are bad for you. They're poison. And then he just kind of threw up his hands and, you know, basically said, like, you know, but what other option do we have? And I wanted to ask him, and I didn't get a chance to, said, well, do you tell your patients that? Because in my view, that is part of full consent. If you told your patients, here's the reality. These drugs are bad for you. They are poison. They may also help you with this situation. Here's all of the information. What do you want to do with it? That is truly informed consent. That is true full consent, where the patient has the ability to look at all the pros and cons and then make the best choice for them. That doesn't happen, because I know he doesn't say that in his practice.
Well,
instead, he just pushes the positive.
That's right. But the other thing is, you say he said, what other choice do we have? There are all kinds of other options.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah. Again,
we don't have
like
any other drugs,
further,
but we have other techniques and supports and structures.
Yeah. And I agree. Like, I mean, but even in a world where we're, you know, where this is the last line of defense and not the first, that still needs to be said, and it especially needs to be said to parents for kids, because kids don't have any agency. When you're 15, you're not thinking about, you know, the long, when you're 15 and you haven't gone through puberty, you're not thinking about whether or not the antidepressant that your doctor and your mother and your father are about to give you is going to affect your sexual health for the rest of your life. That is not on your mind.
Right.
It's not your responsibility. That is the responsibility of the doctor and your parents or your caregiver or the social worker or whoever to know that and to be told that. And it doesn't happen. We don't have really informed consent. We have digital lawyer things that protect the doctor from getting sued. That is what consent means in this day and age, and it's bullshit.
Yeah, I would have to agree. And, that idea of more fully open informed consent would be a deal changer. I know, you know, for a deal breaker for a lot of parents. To hear, mm-hmm. Hey, this is a poison for your kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have these short-term benefits, but long-term, it's not a good thing to keep your kids on them, which is like the basic message from Robert Whittaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, is that long-term, these things have more downsides than up. So.
And that also is reflected directly in the research. So it's not like anyone is trying to pull the wool over your eyes here. I mean, even Whittaker, well, I don't know. I know that in some of the, not Whittaker himself, but in some of the research Whittaker, you know, talks about, and, you know, all of these researchers, in some cases, sometimes there does seem to be short-term benefit, but it's rare. Short-term, we're talking 3 to 6 months, and there needs to be a plan to get people off. None of that is happening. So,
well, hopefully with books like yours and people like you to promote the conversations, we're heading in the right direction. And I thank you again for your willingness to share with our audience and for the courage it took to put this book out.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. You know, the book is available all around the world. You can order it from any bookstore. It's also obviously Amazon and all those retailers. And people can find me all over the internet at Brookseim. So that's BrookSiem. And I don't know, I respond. If people message me, I do respond eventually.
Well, I appreciate that, as well as your spending time with us today. It's been a pleasure. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Timothy.
So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. We're a few minutes early, but Dr. Tim had played a pre-recording. If you didn't catch it, please go back and listen to it. It was a little late coming in, but I'm pretty sure that it's Laura McCowan. And she was a really good interview there. So I hope that you go back and listen. Mike will be with us here in just a moment. I'll invite you to go to our website, whyagain.org. And if you go to schedules, under flyers and publicity, you'll see live events, or you can go to the events page, which is just when you go to whyagain.org, scroll down a little bit, and you'll see the events that are scheduled. And one of the things is that Michael is going to be at Advanced Rejuvenation Friday to Sunday, May the 3rd through the 5th. He'll be doing workshops there for 3 days. So if you get an opportunity, if you live near Sarasota, you can pick up that information either under schedule or under events. And then also, we did send out a newsletter. If you're not on our mailing list, you can either send me an email to Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, or you can go to whyagain.org and scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see a link that says sign in to be on our mailing list, and you can get that. But I've also added them under multimedia and newsletters, and you can pick up any of the newsletters that we've sent out. We started doing e-newsletters in May of 2016 instead of mailing them, and all of those are out there. All you have to do is click the link, and it will open it up. And so the one that we sent out the other day was the announcements on both the personal one-on-one quantum still point intensive that Michael's doing. You can schedule that with him. And also the upcoming Florida workshops. So you can pick those up there in that newsletter. Please be part of their newsletter so that you get updates. Michael's been working on an article about the solution to the problems in the world and in the Middle East. And so that'll be going out again. We'll send out another newsletter here in the next couple of days. And so watch for that. So get on our mailing list. Michael's now with us, so I am going to say welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. And actually, I had decided to go ahead, seeing as how this is all, you know, it's based in the Aramaic. It's another way of expressing it. And it's something we had talked about before, and with the escalation of things in the Middle East, with Iran getting more deeply involved and all the craziness going on, that is the article we're going to send out. It was actually going to be a different one. So I've gone back, and it's not quite finished. There's still a few rough places in it, but I thought I would read it and just get feedback from our audience. And if there's anybody with a question or a thought, let's do that first. So is there anybody out there? Our calling number, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly. And then if you push 1, we'll be having a conversation. So do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up, sweetie, or anybody in the chat room with a thought for us?
We do have a hand up, and it's Susan 610. You're on the air.
Hey, hi. I'll be very quick because I want to hear this.
Welcome, young lady. Okay.
Thanks. I wanted to ask you about the previous show. I tuned in when I could, which was too late. It was pre-recorded, right, Jeannie?
Yes.
Was it pre-recorded?
With Dr. Kim. It was.
Yeah.
And
do you know who he was interviewing?
Well, I was a little late coming in, but I believe that it was Laura McCowan, which she's the author of 2 different books, We Are the Luckiest and Push Off from Here. And then she's also the founder of the Luckiest Club. And I know that, you know, her information is, you know, she had been on the different, you know, drugs and things like that at an early age and her experience after coming off of it. So I'm pretty sure that's who it is. I'll have to go back and listen to the very beginning of the show to catch her name, but 99% sure that's who it was.
Thanks. Well, I may or may not be able to. We're in a real crisis with Jonathan now. He's just completely in a terribly dark place, and we're talking occasionally. So I'll be listening, though. The Middle East topic is very, very much on our minds.
Jonathan is on our minds
as we
do this, and extending love and your direction to support you and your efforts with him and to assist him to opening to the healing presence that you have to offer him.
Well,
so I'm holding the space.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. So go ahead and read.
Yep. Okay, Susan, I got a text from another listener. Thank you, Dawn, for giving me that. It was Brooke Stim, And it was a memoir on what causes side effects.
Brooke, do you spell the last name?
S-I-E-M.
Okay. Is that a new Journey's Dream thing, you think?
I'm not sure.
But thank you. That's great. Tell your texter over there, thank you so much.
Yeah, nice. Definitely.
Okay. Go for it, Michael.
All right. The name of her book is What Causes Side Effects? Is that what I understand you to say, Jean?
I'm just bringing it up, and she's got one that says May Cause Side Effects, a memoir.
Oh, May Cause Side Effects, yeah.
And it's an unforgettable memoir about the turmoil of antidepressant withdrawal and the work that it took.
Yeah, that's big stuff. Well, holding space for her, and thank you for informing. My offering is there's no such thing as side effects. Every drug is a disease disguised as a cure. It can shut down some energies, but which can appear like relief, but ultimately, beside every drug, I don't care what it's, beside every treatment, we've got to put healing. They're two different things. They're not thought of in the world as the same thing. But healing and treatment are two totally different things. Sometimes treatment is appropriate and healing is always appropriate. That would be my offering on that topic. And so now we're going to look at the title of the article, at least so far, is An Aramaic Solution to Healing Conflict in the Mideast. Where Healing in the Real World Meets Scripture, Psychology, Physics, and Medicine. And I'm just going to read, and if somebody's got a comment or an insight or, you know, something to share, put your hand up. I'd be happy to interrupt it. And I'm reading so I get some feedback on how it flows. And one of the things I have learned about myself is when I read something, I can more properly put it in order. So just, and it'll fit perfectly with everything we've been talking about from the Enlightenment book. So you cannot kill, drug, make war on, or punish mental illness out of existence. It must be directly faced and healed. I'm writing this in order to offer information that most human beings seem not to know. You're designed to know yourself as love, for love is the stuff you're made of. You are designed to be healthy, whole, cared for, and function as love. To the degree that you are not in the experience you were designed for, your body, your mind, and your life are going to reflect dis-ease, and you're living in blockage of truth. After 50-plus years of working with people, recovering the truth of this statement, the truth of who they are, it has become obvious to me that instructions on the deepest principles of healing are urgent. Please pass these tools for recovery on to others so they become available to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. If you're uncomfortable, in trauma, under attack, or experiencing pain, these tools are going to change your life. This work will not show you how to treat your pain, for treatment is a world apart from healing. Healing only happens when we learn how to address and change all pain and suffering we experience at the level of cause. If you're comfortable and satisfied with the status quo, this article is likely to bring up a great deal of discomfort. And in fact, it's designed for that purpose. Approximately 4,000 years ago, in a text that is generally thought to be about religion, we discover that in its original language, Aramaic, it is about physics, physiology, psychology, and genetics. In it, a man named Job, after much suffering, offered the world a deep, difficult, and rarely comprehended lesson in responsibility, how the world actually works, and how to own your creatorship. In one sentence, Job explained the physics, the psychology, and emotional dynamics of how repeating widespread traumatic events and suffering are created. And we could put in there, and passed from generation to generation. It's amazing when you really break down that sentence, just how much powerful insight there is in it. And it's in Job 3:25, one sentence. He says it all. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. What Job was acknowledging was that he had troubles due to the functioning of his own mind. He admitted to himself and the world that his mind was inferior to the mind he was born with. When we have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, we understand that Job had the humbling insight that when fear and dread are running his mind, he's working against his own best interests. In admitting his tendency to blame and accepting responsibility for his dysfunctional mind, as we all can do, Job is opening the space for profound healing. He's stepping into the powerful, life-changing admission that he is the ultimate cause of his own suffering, loss, and the traumatic effects in his life. Note that I'm not saying he's to blame. He's just come to grips with his responsibility for his life, something very rare in our world today. In effect, Job is owning the fact that he is a particularly pernicious form of unconscious mental self-abuse, the twin mental illnesses of fear and dread. This, I offer, is the huge and necessary first step in healing. We must give up looking outside of ourselves for cause of our experiences and admit there's a problem inside. When we fully unpack Job's insight and apply it to our lives, we understand our part, as Job did, in causing the terrible events, the repeating generational patterns in our lives. He plainly and emphatically tells us that the feared and dreaded outcomes in our lives begin in our own minds. Life and the people we populate our world with are the result of a process we, through denial of responsibility, have lost control of. When we live in a mind fueled by fear and dread, we're limited to drawing people to us that resonate with a life of conflict, attack, pain, suffering, and seeming hopelessness. And why is this happening to me again experiences? The human mind, I offer, is meant to be fueled by love. Check out the energy natural to us as humans by simply holding quietly and with deep contemplation, one with an untainted mind, a newborn. Notice if its belly's full and its diaper's empty, the state of serenity. Job, when you unpack the seemingly simple insight above, is informing us that when we live in a mind run by fear and dread, and apply those mental energies to a fantasized outcome, we set in mind the blueprint for events that will be delivered to us by life. When we add additional unresolved emotional amplifiers to thought complexes based in fear and dread, things like greed, guilt, and hostility in any of its forms into the scenario, we have the perfect trifecta for victimhood and repeating trauma. And I want everybody to practice saying perfect trifecta 10 times really fast. So this, when understood, is a perfect definition of mental illness. Let's just read that one again. Job, when you unpack the simple insight above, it's informing us that when we live in a mind run by fear and dread, and apply those mental energies to a fantasized outcome, we set the blueprint for events that will be delivered to us by life. And I'm going to change that just a little bit. A fantasized outcome or a genetically implanted. Unresolved. Outcome. We set the blueprint for events that will be delivered to us by life. When we add additional unresolved emotional amplifiers to thought complexes based in fear and dread, things like greed, guilt, and or hostility in any of its forms into the scenario, we have the perfect trifecta for victimhood and repeated trauma. This, when understood, is a perfect definition of mental illness. When we integrate, from the perspective of Job's understanding, truth, the words innocent and victim are an oxymoron. There are no victims, only volunteers. We volunteer by insisting the state of our mind is justified and is an effect of what is happening in our world, and not the cause. The profound conclusion implicate in Job's deep experiential learning is the fact that the power to bring about results in the mind lies in the mind entertaining a complex of negative thoughts and intensifying the energy of that complex with fear and dread. Of course, the complementary implication is that the mind entertaining a complex of constructive thoughts, intensified by the energy of that complex, and intensifying the energy of that complex with love, also has the power to bring about results in the world. It's been called positive thinking. There's far more to it than that. The expression of understanding that Job attained is one of the first historical indications, of which I'm aware, of a rudimentary understanding of the world of quantum physics. Job's observation of how his fear and dread applied to a concept held in his mind is, in fact, a conversation about the observer effect proven in the physics lab. The world that appears in perception to be outside of us is impacted by every energy that moves inside of us because we are all connected. If one wishes to rid themselves of the feared, dreaded event, fighting against that result in the world is futile. For by simple resistive engagement, energy is added to the cause, which is within. Particularly brilliant man's instructions 2,000 or so years ago, resist not evil. As long as fear and dread are attached to a negative fantasy in the mind, the world must deliver on its promise. Ask and you will receive. Guarantee. Somehow, any result will continue to arrive right on time, as anticipated, until its cause is removed. That's physics. This is a statement of our power as human beings to create results in our world. I offer that one of the main purposes of the rest of the books that accompany Job in that collection called the Bible are man's attempt to understand and resolve the dilemma Job presented. How does the blind application of fear to a clearly unwanted result bring about precisely the result in question again and again? And what can I do about it? A family, many families wiped out again. A centuries-old family conflict continues, each ignoring their ancestor Job and blaming each other. And, as in this case, each says, "We really don't understand why this is happening to us again." Shocking events not only in Israel and Gaza, but around the world, in families and communities all over the world. An equally shocking change of thinking and understanding will be needed to bring us to sanity and resolution. Do not expect the answer to conform to your understanding of how the world works, especially where your mind has already put the blame outside of yourself. Notice every time, quote, it has happened to you, you're the only one that was there. If, in bewilderment, you've asked the question, why is this happening to me again, recognize you're going to have to change some of the deepest unconscious dynamics at work in your own mind. And there is only one answer that will ever bring serenity and healing into reach for all sides in every conflict. This Mideastern generational war, as with virtually every cultural enemy and family squabble in history, has gone on too long. No one is born with hatred or enemies. Each is a learned, corrupted construct instilled within any mind that swims in its toxic mental, cultural, and family environments of fear and or hostility. Eventually, until questioned, living in these aberrant states will become normal, knowledge and the way it is. All lies that appear true in a mind that's working from corrupted data. Anyone questioning what has become the cultural norm, like they are the enemy, will be labeled traitor and lumped in with said enemy. This is an idea usually promoted by those who are profiting off of a culture maintaining some particular group of enemies. Notice how often, as profit or other beneficial viability of one enemy fades, another is fabricated. Eisenhower warned us. Major General Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine of his day back in 1935, wrote in detail about it. Read it free. War is a Racket is the name of his book. There'll be a link in the article to that, but if you just Google Smedley, S-M-E-D-L-E-Y, Butler, War is a Racket, you can download from several sites. You can, there's even a recording of it you can listen to. I worked about 30 years ago with a Jewish woman who lived in Israel. She shared with me that she became an activist and advocate for the Palestinian community when her own children were taught subtraction in the community school by minusing Arabs, their brothers. People who they were being taught were the enemy. Though I have no direct experience with such sad brainwashing of children from the Arab side of the equation, I have heard similar stories in reverse. Generational hate perpetuated through ignorance and unwillingness to go within and do the requisite work of cleaning up one's own defiled mind has become the norm. Read 1 Samuel 5:3. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant, suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Read Joshua 6:21. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, the ox, the sheep, the ass, with the edge of the sword. Another version of that passage says, go in and clean house. Don't leave anything breathing. Don't leave a donkey, a child, a woman, an old man, or an old woman breathing. Wipe out Jericho. Those profiting the most from these ignorant, self-destructive commands put them in the mouth of the highest authority, and the wars between brothers go on. One has to be quite ignorant to hold the belief that a creator called love ever conceived of such an insane instruction. The work required for healing? As long as war and traumatic energetic memories exist in the psyche of humans, those dynamics will, when resonating into activity, reflect in the mind as thought disorders, distorted perceptions, and they will play out in the thoughts, words, and attitudes and behaviors in the world, and each will produce destructive results until healed. As long as atrocities remain unresolved in the minds, genes, family systems, in the teachings, myths, modeling, and stories of a people, generation after generation will live and die in the desert of unresolved projected internal trauma reflected in external experiences. Behaviors that produce all trauma are internally generated. These painful actions will be repeatedly played out within the family and or neighbors, which appear as quote-unquote enemies within the unsuspecting self-inflicted mind. Carl Jung defined these unresolved thought disorders carried by everyone as the shadow, part of ourselves we've cut ourselves off from, and in turn projected into our brains images, dreams, and fantasies of others. Give me one second. I'm going to add a word here. In the ancient Aramaic language, these aberrant states of mind, when active, were understood to control attitudes, words, emotions, perceptions, and behavior, and were called devan, or demon. The Greeks had their pantheon of demons and have people chasing non-existent external creatures that are but projections of one's own dissociated mind. Fear, as Job discovered, is what set one such demon to be cast out. Job this projected dissociated insane state of mind, fear. Pardon me. Job, with this projected dissociated insane state of mind, fear, he virtually destroyed his life. How is such a demon cast out? Perfect love. We must put an end to the multi-generational, self-inflicted fantasy of victimhood that many mistakenly swear is true. When in denial, the pretense that something outside of us is the cause of what is moving within causes distortions in perception, a dysfunction of the mind. Due to the dissociation caused by denial, we populate our perception with demons, projections of our own thought disorders. In the ancient teachings, such a mind was called the mind of man, which has metaphorically been described as seeing through a glass darkly, or being lost in the desert. It's been described as the wolf, and in some cultures, the trickster, or the wily coyote. Never facing ourselves directly, we think we can live a normal life pretending there are no skeletons in our closets. These projections are but mentally generated symbols of the parts of self that, in most family systems, have been disowned and kept in the dark. When you realize the human mind is designed to be fueled by love, these dark, unresolved conflicts over generations become the root of perceptions reflecting the mental illness of fear and hostility. In a mind where love is restricted or avoided altogether by unresolved fear and or hostility, aberrant perception governs. Whether the mind is radically infected with unresolved thought disorders so as to be non-functional, or a less injured mind we identified as somewhat normal, angry, depressed, agitated, rageful, violent, what we need to admit is we're talking about a mental illness. In a trauma-informed mind, the shadow colors, defines and gives meaning to everything perceived, including the self and all others. Carl Jung could be seen as confirming Job's thesis about how deeply damaged his life has been by fear and dread when he says, "All of one's neighbors are in the grip of uncontrolled and uncontrollable fear. In lunatic asylums, it is a well-known fact that patients are far more dangerous when suffering from fear than when moved by hate or rage or hatred. With sufficient energetic trauma experienced, the experience of the self, as it truly is, as love, as worthy, as capable, as acceptable, as honorable, as deserving of approval and being cared for, is obliterated. When a mind constructs its worldview and its experience of self through dynamics rooted in thought disorders based in fear, it self-inflicts pain and blocking the fact that it was the only one present and therefore responsible for every painful experience, a mind so inflicted hallucinates an enemy to blame." Unknowingly, the mind caught in its own projections is engaging, as Job implied, in a self-destructive creative act based in fear. Unreal thoughts, thought disorders, bar access to the truth of who we and the other are. Carl Jung brilliantly outlined both the impact and the solution to succumbing to seeing ourselves in the world through such a mind. Until the unconscious or dissociated mind becomes conscious, it will direct our lives and we will call it fate. Greater than all physical dangers are the tremendous effects of delusional ideas, fear-based thought disorders projected, which are yet denied all reality by our world-blinded consciousness. Our much-vaunted reason and our boundlessly overestimated will are sometimes utterly powerless in the face of unreal thoughts. Indeed, it is becoming ever more obvious that it is not famine, not earthquakes, not microbes, not cancer, but man himself who is the greatest danger to man. for the simple reason that there is no adequate protection against the psychic epidemic of projected fear, which are infinitely more devastating than the worst of natural catastrophes. The wolf inside the man is far more a threat to human existence than external forces. When mental forces become so toxic as to harm our overall well-being on an individual and collective level, a psychic epidemic can result. Modern society is prone to collapse due to a pandemic of delusional ideas. Powerful insight from Carl Jung. We, individually and collectively, must stop projecting what we do not wish to deal with within ourselves. The true self-love is covered up by generation upon generation of identification with errant thoughts and feelings and with thought disorders about self and others. Those errors must be undone. If an energy moving within is based in any form of pain, hostility, or fear, it must be owned and removed. If not owned, its underlying cause will remain hidden and therefore inaccessible, and the noise of it will cover up the subtle energy of one's ability to choose to heal. Remember, it was called, pardon me, the still small voice. Each effort at removal, though perhaps insincere and seemingly futile at first, will weaken the noise of all pain. Sufficient weakening and choice will appear full-blown. In Aramaic, the removal process was called forgiveness. None of the three branches of the Abrahamic tree, today considered to be world religions, understood what their common wisdom keeper, Job, offered about the invisible, tragic impact of fear and dread on the operation of their minds and the atrocities visited upon them and the lives of those surrounding them. As a result, someone like the Hatfields and McCoys, these family members have been killing each other for centuries. On June 14, 2003, the Hatfields and McCoys, who had been warring and killing each other since 1963, signed a peace agreement. Perhaps a model for healing? Enemies do not exist in the world. They are a fabrication, a perceptual construct of the projected shadow side of one's own mind. This is why the felt experience of an enemy is so painful. The whole ordeal is internally generated and projected into one's visual and sensory experiences by the brain. And while the mind can be tricked by its own visual hallucinations into believing its projection, believing the cause is external, the pain is still felt in the body, housing the problem of denied and dissociated fear. Now, many will say, oh, none of this applies to me. But let me be clear here. We're talking about any child in any culture at any time in history who's experienced fear and did not have adults who could guide them through healing that fear. And I don't mean comforts them. I mean actually knows how to heal fear. Well, Michael, now you're talking about virtually everybody, including you and I. I think you're getting my drift. One such expression of this dynamic is the parent who attempts to explain away their perverted actions based in unresolved thought disorders toward a son or daughter. I'm only beating you, berating you, degrading you because I love you, and it hurts me more than it hurts you to do this. No, Mom, no, Dad. You're abusing me because you and I are existing in a desert of unresolved generational family trauma, and I offer it does not hurt you in the least to do this to me. It alleviates and gives vent to your unresolved generational pain, the pain you refuse to own and forgive, and the relentless, unconscious fear and pain you live with every day. This seemingly resolvable pain is why people hold their breath, sigh in exasperation, fight, rage and see enemies everywhere they turn. Ever look at the divorce rate? And the number of people who appear to be married but in their hearts were divorced years ago? It's estimated that worldwide in 2022, war and violence ended 238,000 lives, and cost $17.5 trillion. 2022. That's how many people on Earth were killed in war. And that's the estimated cost of it. Can you imagine if we had $17.5 trillion to invest in the health and the well-being and the care of starving children around the world, especially the ones here in America, or I should say including the ones here in America? What could be done with that $17.5 trillion? And by the way, experts tell us that we're living through, you'll get this, we are living, 238,000 people, $17.5 trillion. Experts say we're living in one of the most peaceful times in human history. The Canadian Journal of Peace and Conflict Studies estimates that from 3600 BC to 1974, there have been approximately 2 billion people murdered in war. All because of the healable, generational mental illness of dissociated fear and dread projected. And if we listen to many conversations going on in the world today, we're on the precipice of another avalanche of murderous bloodbaths globally. Rachel Yuta and her colleagues, researchers in the growing field of epigenetics and the intergenerational effects of trauma, have long studied mass trauma survivors and their offspring. The latest results reveal that dependents of people who survived the Holocaust have changed physiology and nervous systems, different stress hormone profiles than their peers, exposing them to anxiety disorders. And I would offer that it also predisposes them to power person dynamics, i.e. doing what was done to them. And that comes from an article on in Scientific America. If you want to look it up, Scientific America, descendants of Holocaust survivors have altered states of stress hormones. Also, if you go on YouTube and look for the ghost in your genes, it's powerful what the research has been done there, what their understanding of these generational energetic patterns. Environmental non-genetic inheritance and susceptibility to disease, epi influences that become part of our DNA have been identified. Job, who lived approximately 2200 BC, told us what infected his life. Even Bogo said it. We have met the enemy, and the enemy is us. Many, if not all, of our wounds and conflicts, and therefore our pain and inclinations toward violent perceptual constructs, emotions, thoughts, and behaviors, are rooted in genetically inherited traumas, Jung's shadow. Multi-generational assaults reinforced through unconscious actions generation after generations projected and stored, pardon me, and projected repeatedly toward family, friends, enemies, and self ad nauseum. Each painful event appears to be a distinct and separate, seemingly connected by nothing except that it's happening again. However, all of those effects are directly connected to unresolved generational trauma. As Job realized, his multifaceted loss and suffering was connected to his own fear and dread. Once again, Carl Jung expands our understanding. He precisely described the source of our unconsciously driven behavior and the seemingly unavoidable repeating of generational trauma and conflict, as he explains why the patterns repeat and the only way true resolution can be achieved. Thank you, Carl Jung, for your brilliant insight. Whatever is rejected from the self appears through blame in the world called perception as an event. We meet ourselves and our projections on others time and again in 1,000 disguises in the path of life. Until the unconscious becomes conscious, it will direct our lives and we will call it fate. Everything that appears to irritate us about others can lead to the understanding and healing of oneself. Again, thank you, Carl Jung. It is a trick perpetuated by a biased, corrupted, perceptual construct in the mind that allows us to think that these events are all separate and separated from each other. The connecting link, when the mind allows us a glimpse, is that they are all based in unresolved trauma that, when activated, obscure the subtle, permanently available human experience of ourselves as our true nature, love. This is a strictly internal problem and can only be resolved internally. When disconnected from our true essence, vision is blocked by internally generated pain that appears to be externally caused. We are reduced to seeing these unresolved but resolvable dynamics as outside events, another trick of the mind infected by fear and dread, an almost universal mental illness that will even play out with their own tender children. But the eye deceives and the ear hears falsely. For those having eyes do not see, and those having ears do not perceive the truth. When in denial, our projections are quite literally painted on the inside of our eyeballs by our own minds. Thought disorders converted to pictures in the mind, pictures that appear to be outside of us, remain unconscious, unresolved in the psyche of individuals, families, and communities, and attack and defense will seem to be the only options. A gentleman named Joost Mierlo wrote a book entitled The Rape of the Mind and says this: totalitarian systems of the 20th century represent a kind of collective psychosis. Whether gradually or suddenly, reason and common human decency are no longer possible in such a system. There is only a pervasive atmosphere of terror, projection of the enemy, imagined to be in our midst. Thus, society turns on itself, urged by the ruling authorities. Again, that's written by Joost Mierlo, M-E-E-R-L-O-O, in a book entitled Rape of the Mind. And, of course, if you listen today in America and how politicians are talking to the mob, there's a particular woman who, to her supporters, told them to strap on a Glock for the coming election. We need to wake up. The illusion of separation and the belief in the external enemy is a substitute for one's own mind turned against itself. It's a result of internal corruption of perception created by thought disorders like those of fear and hostility. Albert Einstein, addressing this issue in 1950, opined the resolution of bondage to block projected unconscious pain. A human being is spatially and temporally limited piece of the whole, what we call universe. He experiences himself, his thoughts and his feelings as separate from the rest, an optical delusion of his consciousness. The quest for liberation from this bondage is the only object of true religion. Not nurturing or tolerating the illusion, but only overcoming it, gives us the attainable measure of inner peace. This is our release from compulsive violence and the endless propensity of the mind to experience depression and pain and therefore manufacture enemies. Once again, the process of release is through first century Aramaic forgiveness. Do we want resolution or vengeance, which, for those in the unconscious, refer to as justice? The 13th century Sufi mystic Rumi offers, love is the cure for your pain, and will keep giving, love is the cure, for your pain will keep giving birth to more pain until your eyes constantly exhale love as effortlessly as your body yields its scent. We must put an end to this multi-generational fantasy of victimhood that our corrupted perceptions, that our optical illusions seem to prove is true. We must rethink the lie that somehow appearing as a victim in one's own perception earns the right to exact vengeance, as we block awareness of damage upon our own psyche by even thinking about vengeance and what that inflicts on us. Justified attack and the triple insanity destroyer of fear, hostility, and blame lends an air of credibility to stories members of warring communities tell each other about those terrible others. The fallacies of these stories is Job's monumental contribution to being restored to mental health and thus having everything he lost restored. That which I feared most. Active present love is the master solvent of trauma. If it is not love, it is generating lies in the mind. Someone in the community has to get big enough to bring healing, first to their own trauma, and then pass that skill to others. Most will say forgive the perpetrators of the events that trigger the hidden PTSD. Unfortunately, this means that underlying patterns, often generational, are ignored and left hidden to be activated another day. Please stop listening to forgiveness advice that says you must forgive them. Forgive continuously, but never forgive anyone. Letting another off the hook for what is original inside the self is total error. The person telling you that the solution to your repeating pattern is forgiving someone else for what is happening inside of you knows nothing about removing trauma from your genes, your mind, your emotions, or your body. If someone tells you that you need to forgive another or yourself, understand they know nothing about actual forgiveness. Never forgive anyone. Yet, again, learn to forgive continuously. I know that sounds like a conflict, but let me explain. When feeling frustrated, angry, annoyed, terrorized, murderous rage, afraid, lonely, aversion, responding out of wounds, when blaming others, when blaming self, when unable to hold to a mind of love, or whatever your challenge is, it's always an opportunity to heal the pain constructs of my own mind, body, nervous system. Sadly, when I hold unresolved pain and trauma within, it is easy to put the underlying energies of that trauma, when triggered into activity, into my brain's internally constructed perceptual images of that other. The experience, the pretense that they're the cause of the repeating trauma I'm experiencing is the true definition of projection. When I make pictures in my mind of others, out of my internally hidden dissociated pain, I believe my mind's hallucination and can pretend others are the reason I'm in pain. In our world, usually, by about the age of 4, each child is brainwashed into becoming a very devout, card-carrying member of the one-world universal religion of blame. This is the way the mind's dissociated trauma, its pain-based interpretation of events, appears to be the truth, which directly leads away from understanding what's really going on and away from healing again. Have you ever been the object of another's devout belief that you're the problem in their lives? Perhaps it's time to question your own membership in the Church of Blame. I repeat, many, if not all of our wounds and therefore our pain are rooted in genetically inherited traumas, traumas that are held inside of us. Multi-generational assaults reinforced through unconscious actions, generation after generation, stored and repeated ad nauseum. Each pain perception appears to be different, but all are based on that hidden dissociated trauma that, when activated, obscures the subtle, permanently available experience of ourselves as our true nature, love. Never imposed from the outside. Blocks to the awareness of ourselves as love are internal and removable if one has the technology to do so. All healing, the return to love, is a strictly inside job. The act of removing intergenerational trauma and pain causing thought disorders is the true definition of forgiveness. All perception is autobiographical. The constructs of our minds tell us first and foremost what's going on inside of us. Until generational traumas are removed, we are easily tricked into believing the false pictures and perceptions generated as a result of denial by our own minds. As long as we believe that something outside of us is the cause, rather than just the trigger of what's moving within, we inhabit a world of false perception, a world made up by our own minds. The shadow. Living in the world of realities generated by our minds voids the experience of actuality, voids truth. Feelings do not come from seeing or experiencing something. They come from the activation of internally generated energies, all self-imposed. Blamers would do well to understand denial. The act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of oneself is the cause of what's moving on the inside. Denial results in instant dissociation, the hiding of truth, which blocks awareness of one's own internal dynamics, resulting in an unnatural condition called the unconscious mind. There's a great tune. I'm putting a link in the article, but there's a great tune if you search for it on YouTube by Alanis Morissette called Madness. She lays this whole article out in a very powerful song. Been through a particular painful reality 87 different times with 42 different people. You were the only one that was there every time. The echo of denial sounds like, you made me so mad. You make me so afraid. You make me so sad. You hurt me. I'm an innocent victim and you attacked me. The very things that people don't want to look at or deal with are the things that are most urgent to be looked at and dealt with. And rest assured, life will give you every opportunity you need. Were you unconsciously directing the show? And life's purpose, when we dissociate from pain, is to kick us right square in the limitation. How do we make the unconscious conscious? The tools for reliably opening what in the ancient teachings was called the veil of the temple, the body, beneath which we keep our pain hidden, the barrier between the subconscious and the unconscious mind, and removal of assault energy appeared 2,000 years ago in the Aramaic language. The ancient tool of forgiveness is a process that uncovers and removes what we've hidden through denial within ourselves. The fake Greek substitute, pardoning, changed forgiveness from an internal process to an outer directed act. Forgive. Let them off the hook, we've been told. With that errant directive, the simple, effective healing technology of forgiveness was lost to humanity. The Greek misinterpretation, we are convinced we need to be forgiven for something rather than realize there's something to be forgiven that is removed from our minds, has left millions letting others off the hook for what is generated by their own minds rather than taking responsibility and removing from their minds, forgiving the projected and hidden, often generational content within themselves. Letting someone outside of us off the hook, what is going on in us, will never rid us of our experience of internally generated hurt, upset, or pain. Outer directed acts do not bring correction to internally generated dynamics. Those dynamics of hurt, pain, and upset. Engaging in actual forgiveness creates a visceral opening that facilitates the flow of light and love into every instant, every experience of our lives and physiology. Alone or lonely, afraid or sad, rageful or hateful, through forgiveness, The space is created for love to flow within and create a clean and open space within the mind and the transmutation, the removal of the energy of one's pain happens in an instant of actual forgiveness. Lived pain or turmoil is always an invitation to end denial, to learn and apply forgiveness. You can go to our website, whyagain.org. There's a book cover in the middle of the page, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Click on that cover, drill down, and you can download that book free in any one of 9 different languages. Perception, the world we think we see with our eyes is an hologram, generator of past content, a projection of the mind. We see nothing with our eyes, we see with our brains. There is no life in a hologram. Neuroscientist Anil Seth explains, perception is a mental construct generated by the body-mind nervous system. The whole world we think we see is an hallucination unique to each person. When we agreed on our shared hallucinations, we call it reality. And you can find that video just by going into YouTube and looking for Anil, A-N-I-L, Seth, S-E-T-H, TED Talk. CIA research, perception is demonstrably an active rather than a passive process. It constructs rather than records reality. People construct their own version of reality. Your mind, based on content resonated by experiences, literally constructs the world you see. Reality or perception, put of the mind, is either a high-quality, accurate picture or a poor-quality, deceptive projection. The experience of the presence of love in one's physiology indicates the mind is on track, and any form of fear and or hostility is an indicator that the mind is using corrupt data to build its projections rather than reflecting accurate information about actuality. When using corrupt data, the mind massages its unconscious content into pictures that appear to be of external things. When I tell you that you're the cause of what's happening inside of me, I have become the equivalent of a full-fledged card-carrying member of that one-world universal religion of blame. All perception, the world made up by us, includes sensations in the body, and they're all autobiographical. Projection is not the act of pretending something inside of me is outside of me. It is the act of building realities out of resonated internal content and pretending that the hologram, that image that results, is actually out there. And in the article, we'll have some links. One will be an awesome piece of work that Magda shared with us couple of years ago on the radio show with her great-grandfather. There'll be a link to the video, What is the World and How Do I Forgive? There'll be a link to the full 3-hour workshop of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? So in the lower level, it'll be live active workshops that people will be able to listen to. So reality or perception, the output of the mind, is simply something we create for ourselves by ourselves. And if we're ever going to change what's happening in the world of conflict, whether it's the Middle East or whether it's right here at home, this is a process that's going to change the game. And so at this moment, that's the completion of our article, and that leaves us with about 5 minutes if anybody has a thought or a question.
You do have a
number five. Okay, let's go for it, sweetie.
Area code 225, you're on the air. Who do we have?
Hey, how you guys doing? This is Sean.
Hey.
Good to talk with you, Sean.
Yeah, good to talk with you.
Are you calling
again
from London?
No, actually, I'm in the States, and you remember the FHU Europe's Skype meet. Yep.
Yes.
But,
cool. Well, welcome. Where are you in the States?
I'm actually in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Yeah, so that's where.
Right down in the swampland, boy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's something. Actually, we had pretty good weather the last couple days, and I've been having a buddy come over, and you know, he brought some food yesterday. We grilled it out on the pit, and we talked about prayer does and energy and all these different neat things. You know, it's amazing. Yeah, I didn't grow up in church or anything, but it's amazing to see, not judging, not comparing, but just seeing, you know, people who grew up in church and they have had a life of churchianity, and you see how limited they are in their understanding or in what they think they know, you know. But
right.
But you know, so you know, and some of these guys, they've been on, you know, the FHU Europe thing and whatnot. You know, you just get people involved in what you can. You expose them to the different things where you can. And he's actually got one of the Why Again books, one of the seven that I got, I don't know, a few weeks ago. So I've given all of them out but three. And
cool.
Two more are set to go to like a last chance school. And I'm hoping to, you know how you can't really talk anybody into doing anything, but, you know, I'm hoping
right.
to talk one of the teachers into doing like a, you know, a daily reading or something, you know, a 15-minute reading on the book, you know, because it may seem odd or whatever at first, but the story is, you know, with Richard is engaging. You know, there's something about the way it's written that captures their attention, but I didn't really call to get all off on to all of that. I actually owe Jeannie a slight apology. One of the things that I wanted to do for you guys was take the old archives and update
right,
them
the radio
from
show.
MP3s to the to MP4 to convert them and then
right.
Get them up to your YouTube for you. But for the past week now, every day after work, I've been trying different programs. You should see the desktop. So my iMac is limited to what it will upgrade to on the operating software, and there are no programs right now that I can get to work. I was able to get on a website, and they allow you to download the old versions. And so
right.
I've tried several of them, and they'll load and they'll start to open, but I can't get any of the interfaces up or anything. So I'm at a crossroads. I would literally have to buy a new computer, you know, at this point.
Right.
You know, and those are several hundred dollars.
Understood.
So. But look, I'll just send you guys $100 to pay it forward to somebody if, you know, if you have, I don't know if you guys actually have anyone who's able to do the work also, you know, until you could get others. But I would encourage you to maybe make a mention every few radio shows or so asking, you know, if anyone is handy in that. But
right.
it's something I would have loved to do, but I'm at a stuck point. Yeah, for the moment.
Well, we'll hold the space that it went, and if the door is it's time for it to open, that will open, and you know, we'll move forward. And you know, basically, what we do is we take all the resources we have, and what's the next project we can do? And you know, this is one
yeah.
of them. So perhaps that'll fall into place and rock and roll.
I've looked at a few different computer options and such, and it's tempting, you know, but. But to spend the money, you know how the whole thing goes.
Oh, yes.
You know. So
for sure.
Migrating all the files and everything like that over. But no, I'll just send you guys $100 or something. And can I do that through the website, right, on the donate
Yeah, if you just go to whyagain.org, the very bottom of the page, there's a donate link, and that would be awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate the support and the willingness.
No, definitely. I wish that I could have that underway, but yeah, it is what it is. It sounds like you're reading something that you had previously written, maybe. Is that right? I was catching parts of the show.
It's actually an article that I'm working on currently live. I'm getting ready to publish it.
Oh, good. Yes. And then, because I've signed up for the newsletter, so I would get that, correct?
It will go out in the newsletter within the next day or two, yes.
Excellent. All right.
What will happen is it'll go out in the newsletter, and it'll also be on a page on our website, and it's something that will continuously be edited for who knows how long and upgraded as we work on it. So,
perfect.
But it'll come out in the newsletter, yes.
Awesome. Well, I don't know if you anyone else who wanted to get up on the show, but instead of just continually emailing with all these excuses, I just wanted to call and talk to you and Jeannie right quick, let y'all know that I'm working on it. But
appreciate
it. Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, for sure thing, and I appreciate answering all the questions and everything. So.
Okay, thanks for holding the space. All right,
blessings.
Take care.
All right, y'all. Lots of love out to you. Y'all take care.
Got it. Returned. All right, blessings. Take care. Bye-bye. And we're down to the last seconds. We're actually a little bit over time. It's being patient with us. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. It's the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.